All right, this article looks cool. Get better at multitasking. Establish goals. Evaluate whether multitasking is appropriate for those goals. Set aside time to give intense or complex tasks full focus. Okay. Choose tasks which are routine, familiar, or fluent. Great. You know, I could have written this myself. I already watch TV, eat dinner, and tweet at the same time.
Do you live, eat, and sleep the hotel industry? Looking to brush up on your game? You've come to the right place. Welcome to No Vacancy, the hospitality industry's number one podcast with your host, Glenn Hausman.
Hey, everybody. This is Glenn. Thank you for listening to the No Vacancy podcast. And this is what space smells like. Thanks for listening each and every week. I want to say that this show is brought to you in part by Duetto, the revenue strategy technology platform that thousands of hotels are using to make more money. Love Duetto. They are doing so many things to empower businesses just like your own. Learn more at GetRevenueResults.com. That's GetRevenueResults.com. And be sure to check out all of these videos that they have up there. Because seriously, it really shows you about how you could create a cohesive strategy that's going to make more money for your hotel. Also, thanks to Red Roof for being such a great sponsor. We really appreciate that. And if you haven't been listening to any of our other shows here on the No Vacancy Network, go ahead and do that now. Subscribe to the Hotel Design Podcast. Subscribe to Checking In with Anthony and Glenn, which I also do with Anthony Melchiori, the host of Hotel Impossible on the Travel Channel. Love that guy. Love that conversation. We're going to empower your career and your souls and make your life in the hospitality industry a little bit better. And of course, you can find the Hotel Tech Podcast on this feed, and we've got some more great series coming soon, all here on the No Vacancy News Network. I'm in the Caribbean this week in Bermuda. I'm having a great time, and I got to tell you, it was very difficult to leave my balcony today looking out over at crystal clear seas, but I couldn't help but want to talk to Mr. Parrish Jordan of HVS, I almost said HFS, like I was in a 1990s New Jersey hospitality industry or something like that. HVS, Mr. Parrish Jordan, who put together Chicos. I'm going to say it's the Caribbean Hotel Investment Operations Summit.
Conference.
Summit. I left out a C there. I was thinking about the other conference, Chios, I guess.
I hear you.
So this is your eighth year?
Yes, it's our eighth year, and I remember you being at our first year.
It was, but apparently I wasn't invited back, but that's probably, I can't blame you for that. I wouldn't have me back
either,
Paris.
That's not true. You've been too busy, but we're glad to have you here this year, Glenn. So happy to have you at the conference this year.
And it's been fun to watch this conference grow. I mean, you started that first year in earnest, and this year you've got, it looks like, about 300 people here. A lot of faces I didn't expect to see, but it shows that you guys mean business.
Yeah. Apart from the attendees, you know, our sponsorship has grown tremendously over the 8 years. I remember the first year we held this conference in Atlantis, 2011, we had four sponsors. And we had about just a little over 200 attendees, which wasn't bad out of the gates. The Caribbean,
yeah, totally.
It's not a large market. It's a mature market. But the thing that we really focused on was having compelling sessions with great information and also great network and opportunities. So we've grown over the years. Our sponsors have returned, and we've added quite a lot more, and the attendees have grown, and it's exciting to be here back again in our eighth year.
Yeah, the thing I focused on that first conference was one night when the conference wasn't on, I had to eat dinner, and I went to Nobu, and I spent over $100 on the meal at Nobu, and I was so hungry, I had to go get a piece of pizza after that. $6 8 years ago at Atlantis. It is expensive.
It sure
over
is.
At that place. Bermuda's expensive too, but it's nice. It's really upscale. I like this place. And in our second segment today, we're going to be talking with Kevin Dallas, who's the CEO of the Bermuda Tourism Authority. We're going to get a lot of great information specifically on Bermuda in that, so be sure to stay around on the other side of the commercial break. But Paris, I'm curious as to what the overall thoughts are about life here in the Caribbean and the hospitality industry.
Sure, great. So, you know, coming off the heels of today, we had a lot of presentations, general sessions from many of the different leaders in the industry, and I myself presented this morning. I have to say the mood has been very, very positive. It's no secret that there's been some bumps and bruises along the way for the Caribbean region, especially over the last 4 years.
Right.
You know, in 2015-16, we had to deal with the impact of the Zika virus. 2017, we had the double whammy of both hurricanes, Irma, followed by Maria. But through it all, I have to say the one word that stands out when we speak about the Caribbean is resiliency. Mm-hmm. It's such a resilient market. In fact, we've seen visitor arrivals increase all of those years, even when, you know, things were not as great. One thing with the Caribbean is when there's bad news, like the Zika virus or the hurricane, it tends to be really focused on one or two islands, maybe right. three or four islands. But the general traveling public puts the Caribbean into one nutshell. So, for instance, most of the Zika impact was in Puerto Rico, but there were other islands that were not infected or impacted at all with Zika, but their numbers went down. And we saw the same thing in 2017 with the hurricanes, right? Some islands were severely impacted, but the vast majority of these islands were not even touched by the hurricane. But
right.
their numbers went down because people just didn't understand the geography. I can't put my finger on
right.
it. But
I was going to say there are probably two reasons for it. Number one is we need to pay our teachers more. right? But yep. The second thing is, I think historically speaking, people just say, the Caribbean. I'm going to go to the Caribbean. And then after that, the conversation about where you're going to go. So I think maybe it has to do a little bit with an education process. People don't realize how vast the Caribbean is. I mean, we're here in Bermuda, hardly the Caribbean. You know, we'll throw them a bone because they get thrown in with that. But it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles away from the rest of the Caribbean, which is really an island chain that goes on for hundreds and hundreds of miles, right?
Correct. You know, it's such a vast area. And then you have Bermuda to the north, and then Trinidad far to the south. And last year, and Kevin will probably expand on this when you
yes,
speak with him.
Yes, and I did, and he does.
And he does, yeah. I mean, people made mistakes. You
yep.
know, they mistook Bermuda with Barbuda, and they were impacted. And that's just one example.
Yeah.
Turks and Caicos was impacted, and they were not hit as severely. So, unfortunately, I think there needs to be some geography lessons, as
right.
you said.
Okay, so we've already learned that we need better geography lessons in school. You know, let's go teachers. Let's, you know, maybe you guys, I got an idea. Maybe you guys could, like, implement a Caribbean island program. Program that, you know, sends maps to all of these schools for future travelers.
We should do that.
Yes. okay. So let's talk a little bit about, we've talked a little bit about the lowlights, but you said there's great resiliency and mm-hmm. numbers have been going up each mm-hmm. and every year. Now, was it 2 years ago or last year that the America's Cup was here?
It was last year.
It was last year. All mm-hmm. right. So that's easy peasy. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're going to get great numbers because that's such a specifically tourist-driven thing. Mm-hmm. However, your numbers are up this year. No America's Cup. That's pretty interesting observation for what's going on in the Caribbean.
Yeah. So specific to Bermuda and with the America's Cup, they benefited last year and their numbers were up notably. This year, there's no America's Cup and they're still up 15%. They've
amazing.
Had continuous growth over the last 3 years. The Caribbean in general, as well, as I said, despite the negative impacts of 2015, 16, and 17, we continue to see growth. There's been 7 years of continuous demand growth. What does that mean? It means more people are traveling to the Caribbean more than ever. And despite the challenges, they still continue to arrive in great numbers. In terms of the performance of the hotels, we've seen average rate and RevPAR, which is revenue per available room, increased 7 of the last 8 years. That is really great for the market.
Right. And the 1 year was down. It was only down like 0.1%, I think.
Exactly.
You said, right?
Less than 1%.
Yeah.
It's a little blip
right.
on the radar. So the market has done very well. And then year to date, we're seeing RevPAR up 3.8%. So coming off of the impact of last year, you know, there's really a story here of two different scenarios. So The islands that were not impacted with the hurricane were seeing a lot of growth for the most part in a lot of these islands, double-digit growth in RevPAR. And then the islands that were impacted, some of them you're seeing like a decrease. And so like the USVI, St. Martin. And the main reason for that is there's not enough rooms. So rooms were taken out of inventory. So people basically don't have any place to stay when they visit. So that's why you see the demand numbers are down in those destinations. But an island like Puerto Rico, which was very impacted by the hurricane, the hotels that are open, and it's 80% of the hotel stock is open today, is doing very, very well. In fact, RevPAR is up 17% year to date through August 2018 as compared to the same period last year. And that market has benefited. It's sad to say it was a crisis, but the hotel market is doing well because a lot of these properties have been renovated, rejuvenated, repositioned to compete better with other hotels in different markets and hotels right. all over the world.
Talk about turning a frown upside down on that one. I mean, so these hotels, they get decimated, but then that insurance money comes in and they can debut all new properties, which you're able to get better rate. You're able to make a better impact with the customer experience and all of that stuff that comes with it.
Correct. As we say, one of my colleagues at HVS says it's helping us, or helping the folks to build a better boat. So, you know, some of these hotels didn't follow the right planning codes. Some of the windows were not hurricane proof. You know, you build a hotel, you spend $150,000 a key, but the studs you put in are inferior. So little things like that really impacted a lot of these owners. And now going forward, they have to follow the right codes, mm-hmm. right? Insurance costs is going up. There's so many other issues surrounding this. But once they receive the proceeds from the insurance companies, they reinvested that money, and the brands helped in terms of getting selling these hotels back onto the market. And we've really seen Puerto Rico turn it around already in terms of the hotels. And there are a few more hotels that will open this year. And by the end of 2019, 2020, they should be back up to full inventory. So it was a difficult time for Puerto Rico, but we're seeing them turn the corner. And then other islands we can speak about that were impacted by the hurricane. So like St. Martin, 50% of their hotel stock is back up and operational.
Right.
But they have properties that are under renovation right now. A couple properties are being rebranded. And then the USVI, too, about 55-60% of their stock is back on the market. But those were the islands that were hit the hardest.
So for an investment perspective, if I'm seeing all of these properties get renovated, does that mean I should maybe be jumping in and building a brand new hotel over there that will open in a couple of years? Or should I just go to islands that weren't impacted and just try to make a splash there? No pun intended.
So the challenge with new construction is that financing is extremely difficult to attain. If you're going to do a brand new hotel in the Caribbean, you have to be a seasoned developer. You got to have deep pockets because the LTVs for loans for new construction is right. like 50%. If you're very lucky, it goes up to 60%. So that means you got to have 40 to 50% of the equity to put into that deal. There's some great markets where you can do new construction, and I would recommend new hotels, but it's just very difficult to get the financing that you need. So
assuming you got all those, what are the great markets that you would peg?
So, you know, you're putting me on the spot here, so I have to name a few. Puerto Rico is always is a great market for hotels. Bahamas, Turks and Caicos, Dominican Republic. So I would say the islands that are closer to the U.S., the islands that are larger in size, but most importantly, the islands right. that have great airlift.
Right. Bahamas is one of those places. So let me talk about the Bahamas for mm-hmm. a second. Bahamar finally opened mm-hmm. After a number of years. I think we should give the listeners a quick understanding of what happened. Massive project, multiple hotels, was going to be a fierce competitor to Atlantis. Lots of problems with the Chinese construction firms and stuff like that. Bankruptcy issues, all sorts of funding problems. Mm-hmm. Didn't really make it. It was like 98% complete. Mm-hmm. And then like 3 years went by or something crazy. Mm-hmm. It's finally open. That's going to make a huge impact, not just for what's going on in Atlantis, but you're telling me it's a hot market. All of these new rooms recently came in and there's still such demand for even more?
Yeah. So listen, if you go back to 2007, and so the person who hears about Bahama opening, they're thinking, okay, that's 2,300 new rooms that's yeah. entering the market. In reality, it's actually less than 1,000 new rooms. If we go back to 2007, when the overall market was operating at 70%.
Right.
What people don't realize is there are a couple of hotels that were taken out of inventory.
Right.
So you had a 400-key hotel called Nassau Beach Hotel. Mm. Then there was a Wyndham Hotel that was over 700 keys.
Holy cow.
you know, and a couple other hotels, smaller hotels that went out of inventory. So now you open 2,300 keys. In essence, when you do the math, you're really adding like 1,000.
Like a boutique new hotel. Rooms.
In Jamaica, they open a 1,000-room hotel every 4 months, basically, right? I may be exaggerating.
But it's the points taken.
Right. And the same in DR. So it really, really depends. And Bahama has opened up and, you know, they have a lot. I was there 2 weeks ago. Fantastic meeting space.
I haven't been over there yet.
Yeah, it's really a tremendous asset. And they've opened and now is the low season, right? We're now ramping up into the high season. So they're preparing for the high season. I know they're generating good group business. Mm-hmm. The meeting space is immaculate. You know, some of the groups that was going to Mexico because of some of the issues in Mexico, a shift in travel more to the Caribbean. And when you look at a brand new hotel with beautiful meeting space, they're probably at the top of the list now. So
I would think so. If I was planning a meeting, I would think to go to a brand new hotel on a great island destination that feels safer than what people perceive Mexico to be.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Makes a lot of sense. All right. So what's the chatter going on here at the conference? If it's difficult to get the financing, maybe what you're seeing here is people connecting to try to get over some of those hurdles that you described, or is it something other than that?
New construction financing is difficult, but it's not impossible. So the chatter is, you know, one of our sponsors, KPMG, does an annual survey. And what they've said is in the last 10 years, this year is the year that you're seeing the greatest appetite and interest for investment by the lenders and by the equity players. And a lot of our speakers from this morning, a lot of experts have echoed that sentiment. I even said the same thing too when I spoke. The reality is, you know, we dug ourselves out of the last downturn.
Right.
And we've had 8-9 years of continuous growth. So now the investors are seeing the growth. And with RevPAR and ADR growth 8 of the last 9 years, that's going to drive investment. So that's why you saw the investments in terms of new development. So, for example, right here, and Kevin will speak later, Rosewood Tucker's Point completed a $25 million renovation this year. You have the St. Regis Bermuda that's under construction and the Ritz-Carlton. Mm-hmm. You have in Dominican Republic the Four Seasons that the Cisneros Group is building. And then we had a recent trade in Grand Cayman where Westin and a Sunshine Suites, which is not a branded hotel, sold for over $300 million. I think the Westin sold for about $800,000 a key, and the Sunshine Suite's about $400,000 a key.
Yeah, you were mentioning that deal off mic yesterday. That's an insane amount of money for a hotel not on the beach.
It's the second hotel is not on the beach, and it's not a luxury hotel. It's sort of mid-scale. So, you know, because I do valuations, I can't really query on the figure and what we think of it. But to your point, it sounds to me,
strategically speaking, and I'll let you answer or you know, feign confusion and we'll move on to another topic. But if you're spending that much money per key, I think they're going to poise it for, you know, moving it up category or two. It's no longer going to be a mid-scale hotel when they're done with it.
All I got to say, there has to be some type of strategy. I think it's a strategy play. Maybe they're upbranding, as you say. Maybe they're adding additional keys.
Right.
But at that price point, it's tough to keep it at that level.
How hard is it to physically build or renovate in the Caribbean? We're talking a bunch of islands here. Everything either needs to be flown in or boated in.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult. And you need to have like a strong local partner. Mm-hmm. Getting permitting process going takes time. You basically have to have good relationships with government officials. You have to go into these offices. You have to pound on doors. You know, it takes a lot of work. And then the physical work of the construction, sometimes you have to import labor. It's very challenging. But the thing is, if you can get it done and you get it done right, there are exceptionally strong barriers to entry. Because you can take a very successful builder slash investor from the U.S. and bring that person to the Caribbean, and they can lose their shirt. I mean, it's really a different environment and market. You got to understand the local culture. You got to be well connected. Otherwise, you can lose your investment.
We always talk a lot about Americans investing in the Caribbean, but what other nations are represented with trying to make strong investments in either existing or emerging properties?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of Canadians. Mm-hmm. Sunwing, they're in the Caribbean. They've been investing quite a bit. Air Transat is looking at deals in the region as we speak out of Canada. There's a lot of European groups, LNR Regional. Mm-hmm. They're players in the market. We have Middle Eastern money always looking for deals here. Asian capital, the deal we spoke about in Grand Cayman, it was a Japanese investor.
Wow.
We've had Chinese investors. So with Bahama, that was a Chinese investor. So they come from all different parts of the world, but primarily from the U.S. and Europe, and then other locations as well.
So what's the future for the Caribbean going to be like in the hospitality industry?
I think we have to be realistic. You need to be a realist. A lot of people were saying many years ago when Bahama was coming in, the Chinese would come in droves.
Right.
The reality is there's other beaches that are much closer to China and Asia.
I also thought culturally they don't really like beaches anyway.
And exactly. And why would you travel 16 hours to the Caribbean when you can go elsewhere? So I think just being realistic, the fact of the matter is the U.S. is the closest market. It's the strongest market.
The half of all arrivals, I think.
Half of all arrivals. You know, of the 30 million visitor, roughly 15 million come from the United States. Every year, more and more Americans are getting passports. Every year, more and more Americans are traveling. And every year, we're getting more Americans to the Caribbean. So you've seen the all-inclusive product step up its game in the Caribbean.
Yeah, the amenities have gotten better. The quality of the food has been getting better. Even the type of alcohol they serve has been getting more premium.
And now you're seeing the brands enter, mm-hmm. the U.S. brands that enter the all-inclusive space.
I remember when Hard Rock debuted their first all-inclusive place. That was like a radical idea to me. I never considered like a brand like that would move ahead with a venture such as that.
Yeah. So the all-inclusive chains have in the Caribbean that operate, typically the locally owned chains like Jamaican-owned Sandals and Breezes. And then you have the Spanish chains that come in like the Sol Melias of the world, Palladium and so on. And these hotels operate very efficiently. And it's been like sort of a hidden secret as mm-hmm. to how well they perform. And I think, I know, the U.S. brands have now understood how efficient and profitable they are. And that's why they're entering the space.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that years ago, people just used to say, oh, it's all inclusive. It's not profitable. It's, it's bottom trawlers kind of a thing. But, you know, you need to be this, this, and this in order to be successful, not all inclusive. That's not the case at all.
That's not the case. In fact, in all honesty, the food, you know, when it first started was not the best food in the world. You know, the package wasn't that great. But to your point earlier, now you're seeing luxury all inclusive. And when it really hit the radar and people realized how great these hotels were and performed was during the last downturn. Because the great thing with an all inclusive hotel is when you pay in advance or you pay there, you know you're paying. It includes your taxes, it includes every single dollar. So there's no surprises.
I've always said that I like all inclusive resorts specifically for that, because I don't want to feel like if I'm having a cocktail or two in the afternoon and my wife is having a cocktail in the afternoon, oh crap, that's $30. Oh, you want another one? Oh crap, now we're up to $60, right? Yeah. And psychologically, if I'm on vacation, I don't really want to be burdened with that feeling when I'm on a sun and sand type of vacation. If I'm exploring cities, totally different, not what we're talking about. But mm-hmm. when I'm lying around all day, I just want to be able to do what I want to do and not have to worry about additional costs.
Exactly. And listen, the hotels are going to go unnamed in the locations, but you know, you book a trip and you get a rate, but by the time you're done paying the taxes and the service charge, you're paying 1.5. If you buy food, you're paying double mm-hmm. what you felt the charge was initially. And with the all-inclusive, you know what you're going to pay. So we saw in the last downturn that market started, those hotels started to penetrate. And now 5, 6, 8 years later, they continue to do better and better. And again, there's institutional capital behind them now. There's, you know, private equity looking at these hotels.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So that's how you know they're serious money makers.
Yes.
When private equity wakes up to it, you know, you probably missed the trend. You should have been in it a year or two beforehand. All right. So one thing we haven't talked about, I'm not even sure you can talk about that. How does cruising fit into all of this? I mean, the Caribbean is a major cruise destination other than people getting on and off boats and, you know, maybe going to have some shots of the Green Turtle and buying some jewelry. Does it make any real difference to the hospitality industry as a whole?
Honestly, not my favorite topic, but I'll give you my 2 cents. At the end of the day, the destinations prefer overnight travelers because they stay in hotels. They spend a lot more money. Cruise passengers, you know, you're like island collectors. You go from one island to the next. But the economic impact for the islands is not as great because a lot of times, obviously, the food and the beverages on the ship. Yeah. So people do, it's a way for additional incremental income. But I do know each of these islands prefer to have air travelers with hotels more so than cruise. So I haven't really covered the cruise industry as much.
I understand. Okay. Yeah, yeah. I'm just curious as to if you had a sense of it, being I have zero sense of it. I figured if you had 1% sense, you'd already be a whole lot farther ahead than me. So for the listeners, the last thing, what do you want them to take away from this conversation today?
The word resiliency, it just jumps out at me. I've looked at this destination. I've worked in the market for over 15 years. There's been a lot of bumps and bruises, a lot of ups and downs, but the market is a very resilient market. If you do it right, if you invest in the right market with the right hotel and keep your costs in check, it's a great market. And we're seeing a lot of U.S. investors actually come into the market now because the yields have been tightening quite a bit out of the United States. So when that happens, the investors start looking further afield, and the Caribbean is naturally one of those places. And they're looking at buying properties that they typically wouldn't look for when the U.S. market is where yields are easier to attain. So bottom line, what I would say to you as an investor, it's a great market, but you have to understand the market really well in the sub-markets. And as a traveler, you know, the Caribbean is open for business. Most of these islands are up and running. We have two or three that just has a few rooms to be opened, but it's a great, great destination. All the islands are different. So, you know, come enjoy Island Collect, but please fly in.
Yeah, I got to get the family down here this winter for a good vacation away. One last question that just struck me. What about the labor pool on all of these islands? Are they sufficient enough to support new hotel development? How does all that work?
You know, so let's talk about threats. Labor is a threat, right? And a lot of these islands do have good labor forces, but they're not focused on hospitality at all the times. A lot of times, so for example, like in Bahamas, they have a strong financial services market. They have an insurance market. And a lot of times, the best workers go to those types of jobs more so than hospitality.
Yeah, it sounds like you're making some money over in those markets.
So in essence, they need to train. The Caribbean needs to train and be prepared for the new hotels that are coming in.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, so final thing I'd like to do is give you a good shameless plug. You've been answering my barrage of questions, some layups, some not so easy ones. So take a moment and give yourself a good shameless plug, whatever you want to say.
So I just want to say thank you, Glenn, for having us on.
Thank you.
And I hope the listeners would, you know, consider Chico's, the Caribbean Hotel Investment Conference. You can Google us at HVS. Basically, we run this conference every year. We go to a different Caribbean island, and it's a great time. There's a lot of networking opportunities, a lot of market leaders. So it's great for networking, basically. Right. So think about us. We do it every year in November, second week of November, and feel free to call me directly at HVS.
Excellent. And don't get it confused with Chico's, which is sensible clothes for middle-aged women. You don't want to do that. Make sure you check Chico's HVS if you're doing a Google search on it. You'll find the absolute right thing. I just know my mom used to shop at Chico's.
So that's okay.
Just so you know. Paris, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate
thank you.
It. And for all you listeners, I think that was a lot of fun. I think you're going to learn a whole lot more about the transformation that Bermuda has been going through with this great interview I have coming up with Kevin Dallas, the CEO of the Bermuda Tourism Authority. So stick around and just remember this. You are vibrating with love and light, pulsating with love and light. You guys are all awesome. Stick around until after the commercial break. Thanks for listening.
Have a question for your host, Glenn? Tweet him now at Traveling Glenn. No Vacancy, the hospitality industry's number one podcast. We'll be right back.
Hey, everybody. Glenn here. So as you know, this has been a pretty exciting year for Red Roof. A couple of months ago, I told you about Hometown Studios by Red Roof and how it's an excellent opportunity for franchisees looking to get in on the incredible explosive growth of the extended stay segment. Remember what I told you in the past. Lodging Econometrics says 27% of all new hotels in the pipeline are extended stay. this market is hot. And today, there's already 40 hometown studios open, with more opening every single week as their $50 million renovation program is completed. Each apartment-style studio offers the amenities guests want, including upgraded decor, kitchenette with full-size refrigerator, on-site laundry facilities, free Wi-Fi, and more, all while continuing Red Roof's tradition of clean, comfortable accommodations at an unmatched value. Meanwhile, franchisees get Red Roof's significant brand awareness, their seasoned management team, and their richest-in-class loyalty program. More than 2.5 million members! And just happens to be the least expensive loyalty program for owners. And that's in addition to their award-winning marketing department and a dedicated website based on their fastest in-class with mobile-first technology. Finally, with Hometown Studios by Red Roof, you'll be working with a company with a franchisee satisfaction of 94%. That's amazing. And twice my high school GPA. And those franchisees will tell you genuine relationships, real results. It isn't just some slogan, it's how Red Roof does business. So get in on the new way to extended stay and visit redrooffranchising.com or call 888-473-8861. That's redrooffranchising.com or 888-473-8861. And tell them Glenn sent you.
Back to the show. It's No Vacancy, the hospitality industry's number one podcast, with your host, Glenn Houseman.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Glenn here, and I am in Bermuda. I feel like I found my happy place. I've been on the road as recording this for nearly 2 months now, going from city to city, having a great time, talking to so many fun people here for the No Vacancy podcast. But I got to be honest with you, I'm getting a little sleepy, but it's nice to be here in Bermuda. It's a land that I love. It just, for me, it looks like Epcot Center, but a country or something like that. It's just so clean. It's so beautiful. But fortunately, every time I leave, I don't have to go out through a gift shop. But I got with me Mr. Kevin Dallas, the CEO of the Bermuda Tourism Authority. Kevin, man, how are you?
I'm just great, and it's great to have you out here with us in Bermuda.
Yeah, I've been here a number of times. I really love this country. I got to tell you, the people are so friendly. It's so clean. It's so easy to get around. And no, guys, I'm not on the payroll here. I just really like Bermuda a lot. Plus, it's super convenient from New York.
And don't worry, that check will clear.
All right, good. Good. You were supposed to say that off the microphone, Kevin. Anyway, I just got here, right? And, you know, last week I was on the West Coast, totally different experience than what I'm having here. But the first thing I noticed is you have a brand spanking new airport coming. Not just a new terminal, but you're building an airport next to the airport so you can have a brand new airport.
We are. So the old airport has actually been around since the 1950s.
Yeah, so I learned today, 1947, which yep. is expansions in 58, 64, and 87. So
well,
that's
all right.
Pretty
you,
crazy.
You are well informed about something that no one is interested
I
in.
I just had an extensive presentation on the airport, so I'm ready for this conversation.
Excellent. Well, so of course, yeah, the old airport is nearing its end of life. Mm-hmm. It is also worryingly close to sea level. So 2 years ago, the decision was made that it was time for a new airport, and I'm pleased that we're more than halfway complete and looking forward to welcoming passengers in 2020.
Yeah, it looks really great. And speaking of sea levels, you actually built the airport up 4 feet higher than ground level. That's quite a project there for a whole airport terminal.
Yeah, there's been quite a lot of gravel going back and forth from our UNESCO World Heritage town, St. George, where there's a container dock across to the new airport site. It's been interesting to watch.
Wow, so you have to truck dirt all the way through the town. And these are there's no interstate highways here. It's lots of windy roads with people seemingly standing in the middle of them.
You know,
a lot.
We have one stretch of dual carriageway that is about 150 meters long, I think.
Wow. Yeah. Well,
we call it the highway.
All right. You're showing off now. So I think that it's beautiful. And to me, it seems very symbolic of what you're trying to accomplish with tourism. How long have you been in this position right now?
So I've been in my current role with Bermuda Tourism for actually just coming up on 2 years.
But cool.
I am actually a Bermudian, so I was born and raised here as well.
So before we get into that, into the rest of the stuff, what's it like growing up here? Everyone I've encountered just seems so nice.
You know, we really are. I mean, I describe growing up in Bermuda as growing up in a small town with no roads in or out.
Right.
But you know, it is spectacularly beautiful. We have the ocean as our playground.
Right.
And you know, we do have a way of life here that I think is set apart and pretty different and pretty special. And when you grow up here, I don't know that you really appreciate it until you leave for a while and come back. I think visitors are always wowed by it. I mean, I think it takes us seeing it from the other side in order to appreciate what we have.
Yeah, I'm just glad that you're lucky enough to live in a small town, but you're allowed to dance. I know a couple of small towns in the USA. Sorry. Well, you know, I like to keep my references timely to the mid-1980s.
Oh, well, yeah.
You know, right around
fair
the last time of the last airport expansion.
Right.
That's my cutoff date for for references. So I think that you're really headed in the right direction here. And the Caribbean has been getting a lot of bad press, I think, over the last decade. So it was delightful to come down here. I had no idea about this new airport. You've got this new terminal that's coming up, 6 great gates. You could expand another 4 if you want. Plus, you have a lot of new hotel projects going on. Before we get into that, what is the state of tourism in Bermuda today, and how do you see it contrasting perhaps to other places in the Caribbean?
Mm-hmm. Well, so, of course, you know, Bermuda is slightly different than the Caribbean. I think we're set apart not only by the experience that we offer, but obviously geographically as well.
I mean,
we are closer to New York than
we
are to
the average people
Caribbean.
Don't know that. And that frustrates me because it's more like the Carolinas would be the closest if you go west.
That's right.
Actually,
our closest point of land is Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So we're counter-seasonal to the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think while there are some similarities, you know, we're an island. We think we offer something that's pretty different. I think it's as frustrating to us as it is to you that's not more widely known.
Right. So a lot of times you're clumped in with this whole category. So you get a hurricane in Puerto Rico, and then you have potential for people not to show up here.
Mm-hmm. Or last year when the New York Times and NBC News and even the British Broadcasting Corporation helpfully announced that Bermuda had been destroyed when what they actually meant was Barbuda.
Right. Oh, my God. I think I remember something like that. That must have been a very long 24 hours for you.
Most Bermudians woke up that day to text messages saying, "Are you all right?" And, you know, we open the curtains and look outside, and it's 90 degrees and sunny and, you know, cool breeze blowing. And, we wondered what they were talking about. And, you know, it is amazing because those things actually do have an impact on visitor arrivals.
Right.
You would think people might check before canceling their vacation, but many don't.
Yeah, well, I could see from the way that people accept news in the United States that nobody bothers to check anything. People take stuff at
that's true.
Value.
And lucky for you. But,
yes. Thank you.
You, I guess, had asked about the more general direction of tourism.
I did. Thanks for getting us back on track, because I am all over the place today.
Yeah, and you know, I think when I reflect on it, I think, you know, for Bermuda, obviously Bermuda boomed in tourism in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and then sort of from about 1980 onward, you know, we kind of let it take a back seat to international business. So, you know, Bermuda is a thriving offshore financial center.
Right. Plus, you're met with a lot of other areas that are up and coming and developing their tourism businesses.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that's true. If you look at the 1960s, you know, Bermuda was kind of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, today, obviously, it's a much more competitive global tourism market out there. People fly further for less than they used to. But in the last 5 years, and you know, I would of course conveniently tie that back to the creation of an independent tourism authority to guide the island's tourism economy and our destination marketing. But you know, in the last 5 years, the island's really found its feet again.
Mm-hmm.
And when I reflect, say, on the last 3 years, you know, the numbers keep going up and up and up to the point where actually, for the first time in my lifetime,
right,
Bermuda needs new hotel capacity, and it's great to see that there are some fantastic projects
that's
now
exciting.
Coming online to do that.
Yeah, now, from my point of view, it just seemed like there was Fairmonts in a lot of places, right? And other than that, there was not a whole lot that was happening. And I guess dual-edged sword, nice, because it keeps it kind of quiet, but you want those tourism dollars. So it's great to see that you have not one, not two, but multiple hotel projects in different phases of development.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we may be the only 21-square-mile piece of land in the middle of nowhere with two large Fairmonts on it. I think that's almost certainly true. But of course, we do have Rosewood Bermuda. We actually have 42 other licensed hotels
I know, I'm just
here teasing. On the island as well. But, you know, the new hotels that are going up, I think you're right. Mm-hmm. They're all modest in scale, which I think we fits what the modern visitor wants. They're all typically 50 to 120 keys.
Yeah, I've been talking to a lot of people about these kinds of hotel developments, and at some point, you see it in Las Vegas, very pronounced, that loss of human scale. Mm-hmm. And I think people want to have more personalized experiences. They want to have more of that VIP type of experience.
You know, the example that I always give to people of that is sort of the story of Marriott in Bermuda. So one of Bermuda's first hotels that was built here was the Castle Harbor Hotel. And the Castle Harbor was a beautiful hotel. People would sail down here from New York. The hotel was only open in the winter, by the way. It closed for the summer because Bermuda at that time was a winter resort. But people would sail down here and they'd stay at the Castle Harbor for a week or a month, and then they'd get back on the ship and go back to New York.
What a life.
And you know, in the 1970s, the Castle Harbor Hotel, which was a modest turn of the century hotel, mm-hmm. you know, got taken over by Marriott, and they built it into, you know, a 350 room Marriott. And you know, I think when we watch what's now happened here, you know, that Marriott closed. All the extensions that Marriott put on the property were all torn down.
Right.
And that property was actually just renovated. It is now Rosewood, Bermuda.
Oh, interesting.
And it's back to being, you know, much more intimate and personal in scale. Mm-hmm. And now fast forward another few years, and, you know, Marriott's returning to Bermuda. Mm-hmm. But Marriott's returning to Bermuda in 120-room St. Regis on one end of the island.
Wow.
And an 80-room or an 80-key Ritz Reserve on the other end.
That's beautiful.
So, you know, we sort of traded that big-box Marriott for three hotels that are all five-star, that are all much more intimate in scale.
Right. Are these the type of customers that are going to be exploring the island as well, or do you think they're going to be mostly there for business or just hanging out on the beach?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, the thing that's, I think, quite different about Bermuda and our tourism product versus many Caribbean islands is, some of you said, which is, you know, the island itself is safe and manicured and small. You know, it's only 21 square miles.
Yep.
So while you might go to a Caribbean island and stay in a vast, beautiful, all-inclusive resort,
right,
you know, and have this sort of slightly manufactured idea of what a Caribbean island should feel like, you know, in Bermuda, we kind of say that the whole island is the resort.
I agree.
You know, if you stay in one of our hotels and don't leave, you know, you're really missing out on what the resort experience here actually is.
Yeah.
So we really think people need to get out and about and see the island, and that they can do so safely and easily.
So safely and so easily. And again, I'm going to be back to the, you know, the fawning all over mm-hmm. here. But I'm recording this at the Fairmont Southampton, and I recall from previous times I've been here, say, a counter right outside. I could buy tokens for the bus right mm-hmm. here, then just walk down the hill, grab the bus. I mean, it's very, very simple route. It's everything goes into Hamilton, right? Everything comes out mm-hmm. of Hamilton. So you just find the direction you want to go.
Right. I mean, I think our buses and ferries are decidedly first world. Locals love to complain about them.
Well, that's your job.
It's still a pretty world-class service. Of course, some visitors have historically all rented scooters as well. And actually, since you were last here, we've introduced a new innovation, which is that we now have electric rental cars. So they are little two-seater vehicles. The first ones that came to the island they're called the Renault Twizy.
Right.
It's a little two-person car, and it charges overnight. And because of Bermuda scale, you can go from one end of the island to the other end and back again on a single charge. So it pretty much lasts you all day long. So it's environmentally friendly and it's safe, and it's a great new way to explore the island.
I like that. The only time I rented a scooter, it was probably not a smart time to do this, on spring break back in college, and my buddy hit my scooter and I wound up with a head injury. So I, not a serious one, but you know, I was 18 and drunk, what do I know? But frown on that, but it was the 80s, baby. Yeah. So everything went back then. Was I allowed to talk about that? Because that was actually 1988, not 1987. Damn, I got to get better with my reference cutoff points here, Kevin. All right, but seriously, though, when I was in the car going from the airport to here, I saw some of those, and I was immediately struck by How much fun is that? Because if I'm with my friend, I'm with my significant other, one of my kids, whatever it might be, that's a lot easier, safer way, especially since you guys drive on the opposite side of the road than Americans do, and I have a hard time with that.
Well, we like to think that the left side is the right side.
But, right. You know.
But fair enough. Yes, that can be confusing to visitors, and I think we certainly think that the... You know, the Twizy and other vehicles like it that are now coming into the market, you know, do give visitors another safer alternative. We still have those scooters, and for, you know, our younger, more adventure-seeking visitors, those are still an exciting option.
Yeah, I think so. And if I was in my 20s, I would totally do that that myself. I like the idea of these cars and that you could get anywhere. Mm-hmm. It just seems so easy. And they're open, and the weather here is just beautiful all the time. I was talking to the driver. He said the coldest it ever gets was, like, 48, and people freak out and wear, you know,
jackets. our winter is January, February to March, and at that time of year, just about every day we're getting up to a daily high of around 70 degrees, and then at night it'll typically be in the winter months, it'll typically be in the low 60s. It does drop down into the 50s at night, although I think 48 might be a record, and I don't know when that was set.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it is cooler in the winter.
It's beautiful.
It's not necessarily beach weather unless you're from Canada.
Right. Well, for me as a New Yorker, that's like, you know, late August, early September.
Yeah.
It's
beautiful. I mean, it's also, of course, for a New Yorker, it's also it's a point of an incredible temperature differential versus what you're going through on Long Island in January, February, March. You know?
Yeah,
Bermuda is still a delightful escape for you at that time of year.
Yeah, it certainly is. So how are you connecting with American travelers and travelers from other countries with marketing to differentiate yourself from other places that people could be going to get your fair share of the travel dollar?
Well, so, you know, when we went and we explored what was it about Bermuda that our visitors found so special, you know, what was it that really resonated, made an emotional connection for visitors with Bermuda? It very much was that idea that, you know, sitting not very far off New York and North Carolina, you know, is a place that is set apart not only by its geography, but more importantly by its way of life.
Right.
And when we are at our best in our marketing and our visitor experience, it's when we are giving visitors that experience and when we are letting Bermudians tell their story in their own voice. So, you know, we try very hard to make sure that all of the marketing that we do is genuine and that it is all in a Bermudian voice. And that what we are doing is we are surfacing up to potential visitors the kinds of things they can actually do here.
Right. Because the last thing you want to do is have the tropes of, you know, the woman laying down with the rocks on her back and walking down the beach at sunset.
You know, I think at this point, you know, pretty beaches and sunsets are table stakes, as you said. You know, that's, you can kind of get that anywhere in the world. I mean, personally, I don't think there are beaches as beautiful as Bermuda's. But
you've got amazing beaches here.
We do. But, you know, with Photoshop, Cayman can make theirs look okay,
that's
too.
That's right. Right.
So, you know, we think it's important that we go deeper than that and that we actually share much more about, you know, Bermuda is this really interesting cultural swirl.
Yeah.
You know, it's an eclectic mix of European and African and even Native American culture that all swirled together into something that is kind of uniquely our own.
Right.
And we think that more than just geography sets Bermuda apart.
Totally. I completely agree with you. Leave it up to Travel and Leisure to include the best beaches list. You focus on the authenticity. That is what travelers are looking for today. And by playing to that real sense of place, I think you have a much higher chance to be able to make those genuine connections with people.
We think so, too.
Yeah. And you connect that to the great infrastructure that you have here and the intimacy of the entire island experience. I think that it's... that's some really unique, good, unique selling points
for
you.
Well, you know, and we started doing that. We started doing that about 4 years ago. So, before the Tourism Authority existed, you know, it's fair to say that in the 30 years before that, Bermuda sort of suffered from strategic drift in tourism, but also marketing drift. You know, every new minister of tourism meant a new marketing consultant, meant a new marketing strategy, meant a new tagline and positioning for Bermuda. And, you know, it was all manufactured for us by somebody else rather than something that we were doing ourselves.
So right.
It lacked that authenticity.
Right.
And so I think what we found is that going right back to basics and presenting ourselves as we really are, actually, that's something that is resonating with visitors, and the results kind of speak for themselves. I mean, if I reflect on the last 3 years, I think, you know, air arrivals, which are the most important metric to us, or among the most important metrics, are up nearly 40%. And visitor spending is up nearly 60%.
Wow.
So, you know, we feel like we're connecting with the right visitors and that those visitors are, as a result, coming to Bermuda and spending more when they're here.
Wow, that's very compelling, the whole mm-hmm. argument here. So do you feel you need or want more hotel development at this time? And if so, how do you plan to mm-hmm. bring the people in terms of specifically like that air service we're mm-hmm. talking about?
Well, so, you know, with four current construction projects and the new airport, actually, at this point right now, we're kind of juggling the demands on our construction industry.
Right.
I don't think we could add another development right now.
I think I saw 70% of people building the airport are native, which means you have to bring in a lot of other people because of the lack of workforce.
That's right. I mean, I think there are
also specialists.
I mean, I was going to say, I think we have a strategy like every country of trying to put our own people to work first.
Of course.
But where we have specific skill shortages, we do send for, you know, we send for qualified folks from overseas. But, you know, for us right now, given limitations on things like container docks, and as we talked about those narrow roads, you know, bringing in enough steel and getting it where we need is kind of keeping us all pretty busy.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly when we look sort of 3 to 5 years out, I think we do see potential. There are 7 or 8 sites that either used to have tourism mm-hmm. development on them or could do in the future. They're, for the most part, everything that is genuinely virgin in Bermuda at this point is fully protected.
Right.
But there are a number of redevelopment sites that offer potential for tourism development. So we would like to see further development. But right now we're focused on getting these projects that are ongoing to the point that they're welcoming visitors in 2020.
Now you've got me curious about something, because you do have not a lot of land and you have mm-hmm. very limited spaces. So must be a real agonizing process to determine what to do when a piece of land is available. Do you hold it for 5 mm-hmm. or 10 years for a hotel, or do you just make some apartments or something like that?
That is certainly an issue. And actually, our zoning is pretty careful to make sure that we both protect green space and that we protect those tourism development opportunities to wait for, you know, the right opportunity to do the right project with them rather than you know, letting them go to the highest bidder.
Totally. Interesting. So what am I missing about the Bermuda tourism story?
So, you know, I think we've talked pretty comprehensively
about
what's going on. You know, I think
if I
reflect on it, you know, I think we've had a fantastic run over the last 3 years. We've built a lot of credibility by rebuilding demand for tourism. We're really excited about the new supply that's coming online. We think the new properties that are in development now will bring a lot to the Bermuda tourism experience. And, you know, I think the only thing that we maybe haven't talked about is that you know, we've also got, I think, a really robust plan to make sure that tourism continues to head in the right direction here. So just 2 weeks ago, we launched our new national tourism plan.
Oh, cool.
Which, you know, isn't just a plan for the tourism authority. It really is designed to be a national plan. So we surveyed thousands of Bermudians and thousands of visitors in its creation. We involved hundreds of stakeholders in the writing of the plan, which makes it an agonizingly slow process. We started working on this in January of this year, and we just published it.
And I just got a copy placed right in front of me.
There you go. There's a 100-page version of that, and there's a 200-page version of that. But what you have in front of you is the abridged, designed to be readable version.
I like this one. Lots of bullet points and nice colors. And,
yeah, I was gonna say, and you know, in some Bermudaful colors, as we would like to say. But yeah, no, it's you know, it boils up to something pretty simple. It's it's a 7-point plan that talks about the need to grow awareness and relevance for Bermuda.
Right.
So making sure that we continue to get the word out there about who we are and where we are. It talks about making Bermuda a greener destination. So as we continue to grow, making sure that we actually lessen our environmental footprint instead of increase it. Mm-hmm. It talks about improvements in our infrastructure, which is, you know, partly about bridges and ferries, but actually more about all the things that are needed in order to make that visitor experience seamless and to make it friction-free.
Right.
It talks about local involvement, how important it is that Bermuda's wider community get involved in the tourism industry, particularly with all these new hotels opening.
Taking an environmental tint.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this is pretty cool.
Yeah,
comprehensive.
It is a pretty comprehensive plan. You know, it looks to innovation.
Right.
It also looks to the role that teams and sports tourism and groups plays, particularly in outside those summer months.
Speaking about sports teams, you got a lot of rugby folks over here, right?
Yeah,
now.
We do. We're in the middle of the Bermuda World Rugby Classic,
right.
So we've got teams here from all over the world and visitors here to see it. It's a week long event, you know, held at our National Sports Center.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a pretty special kind of unique event, and it's exactly like Bermuda. You know, it's a sport that's played elsewhere, of course. It's rugby, but it's done in a slightly uniquely Bermudian way and at a scale that is digestible and accessible to people. So you don't really need to know anything about rugby. You can buy a ticket and show up, and chances are, you know, someone will hand you a beer and somebody else will try to explain rugby to you.
Yeah, that's perfect. I love it.
Yeah.
That sounds like a really nice time.
Yeah. And then the last point of that national tourism plan is really around, you know, I think we've touched on it in several ways, but really about making Bermuda into a year-round destination again. Mm-hmm. You know, we used to be a winter destination, then we were a summer destination. You know, I think that Bermuda has four very distinct seasons that each have their merits and each have their unique visitor experiences and signature events to deliver. And so going forward, we want to make sure that our marketing really draws out what those differences are, rather than trying to pitch, you know, an idea that Bermuda is the same year round, which it's not.
Right. Excellent. Well, that's really terrific. Last question for you. As CEO of the Bermuda Tourism Authority, are you legally required to wear Bermuda shorts, or are you allowed pants every once in a while?
You know, my job contract actually does talk about attire.
Right.
you know, it does talk about the need for what it calls national dress.
Right.
So I suppose you could say that. Yeah, the shorts are a job requirement. Actually, the shorts and shirt are both both from local Bermuda brands. We have a pretty thriving local artisan community that produce these things. I do get told that maybe I should wear a jacket and tie a little more, but you know, come on, we're in Bermuda.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I like it. I'm very happy for you that you get to dress that way.
Well, do you have a pair of Bermuda shorts?
I do not have
a pair
of Bermuda
shorts. We'll have to solve
that
before you leave.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. But, you know, I'm a little embarrassed with my legs, especially with all these giant rugby men around here. I don't know if I could pull off shorts in front of all of them.
That is true. I have heard from one of my coworkers that you're going to wear the shorts. You got to spend the time on having good legs.
And you're also perfectly dressed in case you get kidnapped and wind up at a party on a yacht. So that's really good too.
That is true. Funnily enough, last week we were at the Fort Lauderdale boat show talking about changes that Bermuda's making in our super yacht legislation and boat chartering that'll make it more attractive for super yachts to visit Bermuda.
Awesome.
So we were at the Fort Lauderdale boat show, and yeah, it turned out I was perfectly dressed.
That's pretty cool. I love it. So, Kevin Dallas, this is your perfect opportunity now for what I like to call a shameless plug. So whatever you want to talk about, go for it. How do we invest in Bermuda? How do we come to Bermuda? Tell us anything we want to know.
All righty. Well, I think if anybody wants to invest in Bermuda, they are very welcome to get in touch directly with the Tourism Authority. We can be found at gotobermuda.com/BTA. And I think for everybody else out there, you know, there's never been a better time to visit Bermuda. And with, you know, demand rising, I'd get in fast. So, funnily enough, go to Bermuda.com would be the place to start for that as well.
Beautiful. I love it. And I want to thank Kevin Dallas for being here today. So on behalf of Kevin and myself, Glenn, thanks for listening. And I'll be back next week. That is, unless I have too many dark and stormies and wind up getting kidnapped and go to a yacht party.
We can always hope.
Yeah. See y'all next week.
Thanks so much for listening to No Vacancy, the hospitality industry's number one podcast with your host, Glenn Hausman, online at rouse.media, on Twitter at TravelingGlenn, and on Facebook.com/Glenn.Hausman. We'll catch you next time.